Support comes from the St. Louis Chamber Chorus. Season 68 concludes at John Burroughs at 3 p.m. on May 26th with the United Nations commissioned Voices of Today by composer Benjamin Britten, featuring youth and adult singers. Tickets at chamberchorus.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Every generation has a sense that what it's faced has been unique. People born between 1999 and 2005, however, can rightly claim they've lived through a lot already. As the St. Louis Fed's 2024 State of Economic Equity Report points out, that swath of young people has already lived through two recent periods of historic economic precarity: the COVID-19 recession, aka the Great Lockdown, and high inflation, plus, quote, the tightest labor market since World War II. Here to talk with us about that report and what it says about how young adults ages 18 to 24 are doing now when it comes to money, mental health, and prospects for the future, we welcome Anna Hernandez-Kent, senior researcher with the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. Anna, thanks so much for joining the show today.
Thank you for having me, Elaine.
More than a third of young adults in the U.S. reported having no wage or income. Anna, what does that mean? And what makes it so striking?
So this report, which was produced by the Institute for Economic Equity, I'm going to be talking about this data and my views and not necessarily those of the Fed or Fed system. But the reason that this is so striking is because these recent numbers, a third of young adults not having income or wages, that's up from 1990, roughly the time when I was born, so roughly 30 years ago or so. And at that point, it was only one in five. So the fact that we've seen such an increase in this population that is not having wages or income, it means what are they doing? We have to question then. Are they in school, perhaps? That is a portion of it. But even if we exclude those who are currently students, we still see this rise in that share. And that's certainly troubling.
Mm-hmm. Now, the question, what are they doing, could come across as judgmental or even accusatory. What is the perspective from which you're looking at a number like this?
Absolutely. So that's certainly not the view that we want to be putting forth, that it's negative necessarily. Of course, people are faced with different challenges and opportunities, and there's not necessarily a good path or a negative path that they're taking. The reason we're concerned about it is because when I say, what are they doing? We have this number that we're able to calculate of disconnected youth. And for the overall population in the U.S., we see that number is roughly 14%. And by disconnected youth, I mean young adults, rather. I mean that they're not in school, and they're also not working. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of what are they doing, well, they're not necessarily putting in the effort and time to either get an education, get those credentials, and they're also not working. So they're not acquiring retirement savings. They're not acquiring savings to save for a house, a down payment, or even future education. And so it's concerning to us because they're not potentially building for their future financial stability.
Mm-hmm. And then on the other side of that, I mean, you have the young adults. What kinds of sort of living situations are they in that really underscore why this group needs some special attention?
Well, we know that certainly young adults, those, again, 18 to 24, they have had an uptick in staying with their parents. And so we know that that's a bit of a living situation. And much of that is because of what you talked about in the beginning, Elaine. They have been in a economic state where we are faced with high inflation. And so it's very, very difficult for them to acquire a house, let alone rents. Rents have been skyrocketing as well.
Right.
So it becomes difficult for them to then own their own place, and they have to either share with a roommate or a partner or a family member.
Mm-hmm. Now, to what extent is all of that related, Anna, to another finding in the 2024 report, which involves comparatively high rates of depression?
That one was certainly concerning as well, because that's something that we're seeing, right? And it's a confluence of various different factors. Firstly, that people perhaps are more willing to talk about mental health. And I think that's certainly positive. I'm actually a psychologist by training. So mm-hmm. I find that very positive, that people are more willing to seek help and to talk about it openly. But what we have been seeing is since 2017, there's been a divergence, a split between young adults, again, 18 to 24-year-olds, and older adults, where before their self-reported depression numbers were tracking each other quite closely. They're no longer doing that, to the point where in 2022, young adults had a depression rate of over 50% higher than older adults. And so perhaps it is that maybe, younger adults are more willing to talk about it. But it is concerning, right? Because depression isn't just an isolated mental condition, right? It has an impact on the economy as well if they are perhaps staying out of either education or having a job because they're depressed. Mm-hmm. Or if they have a job, we know that depression and other mental illnesses are more likely to have people have lower productivity, to take days off. So it has a wider, broad spread economic impact.
Mm-hmm. And insofar as the way that data on depression was captured, were the survey questions that you asked like a sliding scale or yes or no? How did you get that information?
So the depression and a lot of these questions, we didn't ask them ourselves. We're using different surveys. For example, the Household Pulse survey, a broad survey from the census that was asked for hundreds of thousands of people. Mm. Over the years, especially from COVID, they were asked at a very high frequency. And so, again, these are self-reported numbers. So there is potentially a little bit of that as well, that maybe younger adults are more willing, again, to be open about it. But regardless, we've seen that this change has been happening since before COVID, also mm-hmm. since 2017. So, mm-hmm. These young adults are faced with a variety of pressures. They have the social comparison aspect with things like Instagram and that feed that older generations didn't necessarily have. And so that might also be leading to these higher rates.
Mm-hmm. Now, for those who may be thinking, why is the St. Louis Fed asking questions about depression or looking into that particular aspect of well-being? I mean, why is that important in terms of economic health?
Mental health is critical. Right. I mean, I think more and more people are realizing that mental health is similar to physical health. We wouldn't ask why would we care if people are able to go into work, if they are sick and they have to take time off. Of course, that's going to impact their productivity and therefore businesses' productivity and bottom lines as well. It's the same thing with mental health. It just happens to be invisible. And so people are going in to work or they're not going into work because they don't feel that support and those resources. And for young adults especially, we see that this is the case.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a segue to how young adults feel about their financial situation, there may be some millennials who are listening to this conversation right now and thinking to themselves, well, I graduated from high school or college in the late aughts during the Great Recession, and I got off to a terrible start. So to what extent, Anna, are the experiences of people ages 18 through 24 comparable to those who were in that same age group but facing the economic situation of the late 2000s?
So I think when we talk about generational differences, there's always this sort of internal spark that people want to say, but my generation always had it worse, right? As a millennial myself, I know when I've given this talk to boomers, for example, they'll say, well, I was able to do it. I went to college. I had worked my job, et cetera. I don't have any debt. And it really is kind of this like very narrowed lens that people take a look with their own lives, rightly so. I mean, that mm-hmm. it's difficult to kind of pull yourself back and see the broader macroeconomic impacts that are influencing your life. And so for millennials, absolutely. They were, as you said, graduating into a very difficult job market. And differences there, I would say, was that even though the COVID recession had huge, high, very high amounts of unemployment, it was very short-lived. Mm-hmm. And the supports were also very, very strong. Multiple things that we can talk about. But for millennials, the Great Recession lasted a very long time. And so we know from economic research that if you are graduating and trying to get a job when there is a downturn, that has an impact on your later life mm-hmm. Income earnings as well.
Yeah. So researchers asked how young adults, how they were feeling about their financial situation, and the results varied widely with notable differences by race. So the report shows that roughly 3/4 of white and Asian young adults said they felt they were doing quote, at least okay financially. And then just over half of Black and Hispanic young adults, on the other hand, reported feeling at least okay. Now, are those numbers consistent with findings for adults over age 24?
I think we're always seeing those same racial patterns, right? The numbers may shift, but we always see those gaps by race and ethnicity. And that's something that we looked into extensively, both by income as well as wealth. And then the subjective financial well-being, which is the numbers that you're citing there. I think some other numbers that are really critical are in that study, we found that a third of Black young adults said that they would be completely unable to handle a $400 emergency expense. Mm-hmm. And $400 really at this point is not that much, right? If you go to the emergency room and you don't have health insurance, that's going to blow that out of the water. If
right.
you have a car repair that's needed, that's likely going to be more than that. And so the fact that so many young adults, especially Black and Latino young adults, said that they would be unable to handle this kind of expense, that's very concerning.
Mm-hmm. And what is it that makes these findings noteworthy insofar as economic outlook for sort of the population more broadly?
So one of the things that I want to bring in is I was part of a Federal Reserve system group that looked at potential GDP gains in gross domestic product from closing gaps, racial and gender gaps in the labor market. And we saw such potential gains from that by state level. And you can look that up at vetcommunities.org. And so one of the things that I really like to highlight is that we're leaving economic potential on the table. That's really what it comes down to. So if we're not supporting these young adults, particularly by race, ethnicity, by gender, then again, companies are missing out on a lot of that potential future leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also, they're not going to be building retirement savings. They're not going to be building savings to be able to pay a down payment on a house, et cetera. And mm-hmm. so the economy as a whole is not gaining from that where they could be.
We're speaking with Anna Hernandez-Kent, who's a senior researcher with the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank, and we're discussing their 2024 State of Economic Equity Report, which is focused on young adults ages 18 through 24. Anna, you mentioned gender. Can you talk a little bit more about gender and how that accounts for disparities, specifically within that young adult age range in that group?
Absolutely. So gender and specifically women versus men, although we do have some work on LGBTQ status as well. But looking at the binary women versus men, we find that along all of these different measures, along income, along wealth, along financial stability and subjective financial security, they're more likely to say that they're more fragile, right,
mm-hmm.
than men. And what does that come down to? So in some of the work that I've done, I've looked not just at gender, but also parental status.
Sure.
And one of the interesting things is, at least for wealth, if we look at single women without children and men, regardless of whether or not they have children, their wealth doesn't differ. Where it does differ is for single women with children. Their wealth is almost nothing. And so I think that is a really critical point, that we're not supporting women and families and the economy and our communities if we're not supporting the childcare system as well.
Mm-hmm. And that was something that was highlighted even more by the pandemic.
Absolutely. I've been part of so many conversations with people that are experts in this space, and there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of momentum and positivity around the childcare space right now, and I think that's really positive because, as you said, the pandemic highlighted this issue. We were able to have a glimpse into our colleagues' lives who maybe had a child running around in the background. And so I think, again, this is really positive for women, but of course, more has to be done.
Mm-hmm. Now, the research did turn up some positives, and one of the surprises had to do with wealth, Anna. Tell us about that.
Well, I don't know that I would exactly call it a surprise, because as you said, we were talking before about racial and ethnic differences. So for wealth for this young adult group, they had about $11,000 roughly in median wealth. That means that half of them had more than that, half of them had less. And the overall population is about $192,000, so 17 times more.
Mm-hmm.
That's not terribly surprising because, again, these are really, really young adults. They haven't had time to build up that wealth. They maybe have debt. They don't have a lot of assets. Where there is separation is that racial divide again. So Latino and Black youths, young adults, had much less wealth than their white peers. And so this is indicative of just that chasm, that gap that appears very early on in their lives.
Mm-hmm. So what's to be done about that? I mean, this is research, but what sort of actions might this lead to such that there would be more equitable wealth among young adults who are eventually going to be adults without the young part in front?
Yeah, it's such a difficult question. I think we had recently at the St. Louis Fed a racial equity roundtable where we brought together experts from around the country to ask these very kinds of questions. And the consensus was that we already know what works in many regards, right? It's just, do we have the time? Do we have the effort that needs to be put into it to make these solutions actionable and reasonable and implemented? And we certainly know in terms of positives that there are places that are doing these kinds of things. So in St. Louis itself, we have Mission St. Louis. We have Dream Builders for Equity, a company that is giving young adults, youths in this regard, high school students, they're paying them to rehabilitate, refurbish housing in North St. Louis. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a double bonus. So there are places that are already putting forth some of these solutions in a positive way.
Mm-hmm. What other kind of response has the report elicited, particularly locally, but also because you're covering a region? How have people taken up what is in the report?
Yeah, so we have connections with a lot of nonprofit leaders, and we have on-the-ground boots people on our team that talk to community members. And from everyone, what we've seen overall is overwhelming sense of, yes, this is what is happening in our communities. Thank you for looking into it. And I really enjoy being part of the Institute because we like to be responsive. And so, every year, the State of Economic Equity Report focuses on something different, and it's based on what we've been hearing. And that was something that we were hearing a lot in 2023 was, how are young adults doing? There's a lot of barriers that they're facing. What can you tell us more in terms of data? And so that was a response to it. And so again, for 2025, then we're going to be thinking about what we're seeing in 2024.
Mm-hmm. And in our last minute and a half or so, I mean, is there anything that you feel it's important to emphasize, yet not to overstate?
That's a difficult question because I think all of it is important as a researcher and an author of the study, of course. I think going back to the mental health component, I think that's so critical. Sometimes things can sort of just be a checkbox, but it's not a checkbox if you're experiencing that pain in your own life. Mm-hmm. And so just ensuring that those kinds of supports are available. And I think support is a really key word, too. We talked about childcare. We haven't talked about other barriers, but things like transportation and housing, affordable housing, are also very large barriers. And so being able to have wraparound services that can support these young adults and gaining all of those things so that they're able to get that job, they're able to have that education, that can really have a boon to the larger economy as well.
Mm-hmm. And then the last one, next year's report and its focus, do you know what it is?
So like I said, Elaine, not quite yet, but we're happy to hear what people think are as important in their lives so that we can give you that data.
Anna Hernandez-Kent is a senior researcher at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. Anna, thank you so much for coming to talk with us today.
Thanks again for having me.
This episode was produced by Elaine Cha.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
in Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights. At Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on the Gateway, on the STLPR app, and wherever you get podcasts.